Jason, John R. Law, D.D. White Charter, Fire Department Council, R. Lee Cobb, Don A. Rice, Apple East.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm John Walk, along with Jamie White Carver. Seated to my right, we represent Celebrate Virginia South LLC and related entities in this consolidated appeal. The facts of the case, very simple. Tax collection proceeding by the City of Fredericksburg, collecting substantial amount of real estate taxes and CDA assessments related to the Celebrate Virginia South development of my clients. We have been before this court previously in the case CBAS 2 v. City of Fredericksburg in 289 Virginia. And as the court observed in that case, the proceedings here are purely a creature of statute and strict compliance with the statute is required. And in this case, our appeal presents purely a question of compliance with the statute. Specifically, we're talking about 58.1 3965A, which creates this remedy of being able to forcibly sell a landowner's property in satisfaction of outstanding taxes and assessments, but simultaneously conditions that remedy on compliance with certain procedures. The pertinent one here being a notice letter required to be sent out more than 30 days prior to the case being filed, and specifically required to be sent to the trustee under any deed of trust on the property. The statute does contain an alternative that excuses the necessity of sending the notice letter to the trustee if you join the trustee as a defendant when you file the case. But in this instance, neither one happened. The trustee was not sent the notice letter, nor was the trustee joined when the case was filed. We pointed this out to the trial judge and sought dismissal, upon which the city moved for leave to file an amended complaint, which then brought the trustee into the case. Our contention before the trial judge and before this court is that where you have a statutory cause of action and the statute that creates the claim simultaneously conditions it upon compliance with certain required procedures, if you don't follow those procedures, you do not have a case. And the court did not acquire active jurisdiction, which I'll get into in a moment, and thus the sole remedy was to dismiss the complaint. And then what happens
and then
next?
Thereafter, what?
Justice Powell, what
and
happens
refile?
Next would be a function of whether the statute has some limitation or some overriding statute of limitations.
Is there anything in this statute that would have precluded them had the court dismissed their case from going right around to the clerk's office and refiling it?
Absolutely not, Justice Powell. The remedy here would have been a dismissal without prejudice, without question.
And so why, counsel, tell me why you believe that this court could not allow them to amend their complaint to join the missing party?
Well, it goes back to the question of active jurisdiction, Justice Powell, and that is unquestionably this court had potential jurisdiction. But as the court observed close to 100 years ago in Parent Investment Corp. v. Francis, in order for potential jurisdiction to mature into actual jurisdiction, there are other elements required, and where you have a statute, as we do here, compliance with the statute is required. And as the court termed in that case, if you don't comply with the statute, then the matter is quorum non judicis, meaning not before the judge.
Am I correct that all this statute requires is either notice or name them as a party?
That's correct.
But the statute doesn't specifically say name them as a party with the first filing.
Well, I have to concede you're correct on that one, Your Honor. The specific language is that the notice be sent to the last known address of any trustee under any deed of trust if such trustee, quote, is not otherwise made a party defendant. So that is the language in the statute.
And so why wouldn't all of our jurisprudence about amending complaints and bringing in parties then fill the gap if they're not named initially?
Well, the answer to that one, Justice Powell, again, goes back to the concept of active jurisdiction. And in the treatment on this very subject in Lyle's work on pleading and practice, which was cited by this court in Barrett Investment Corp. v. Davis, it says if you do not have active jurisdiction, then the only power the court has is to enter an order dismissing the case. And in this case,
unless,
as I said, unquestionably the matter could have been refiled.
Unless, of course, the court acquires active jurisdiction. So the Lyle statement is a truism. If you don't have active jurisdiction and there's no waiver and there's no other procedural exception, then of course you dismiss it. But here there was an amended complaint. I mean, honestly, I'm following up on the Justice question about the no harm, no foul. I mean, if you file against someone and you don't get service and you have no personal jurisdiction, there's no subject matter jurisdiction. It is void. But you amend your complaint and then reserve the right people. If you leave out an indispensable party in the first instance, and there's no jurisdiction because it's indispensable, active or subject matter doesn't matter, you can add them later. So why is adding them later, as Justice Powell said, not, in fact, as the trial judge intuited, the obvious cure? I just don't understand.
Well, let me answer this way, Justice Kelsey. First of all, very cognizant of Rule 1:8 and the idea that amendments are to be liberally granted and all the precedents that follow from that. But as this court has recognized in numerous different circumstances, never this exact one, I will admit, but like, for example, in Chesapeake House versus Virginia National Bank, not all defects can be cured by amendment. Your question more or less presumes that everything can be cured by amendment.
Well, this non-joinder. I think our case is a non-joinder case, isn't it? Because joinder is what the statute requires, notice of joinder, right?
Correct.
Okay, so we don't have notice, so we do have joinder. So isn't this, what am I missing here, Mr. Wolf? This is just a non-joinder case. Someone makes a point that, you know, you're missing somebody, it's got to be here. They go, okay, darn good point, I want to amend my complaint and add them. So they add them.
Well, that is what happened. You're correct, factually, Justice Kelsey, but the point that I'm making is this court has said in other circumstances, which we would contend are analogous, Chesapeake House being an excellent example where you have a case filed by a plaintiff who had no standing. The motion to amend was made to say, I have a joinder problem. I just need to switch out plaintiffs and substitute a plaintiff with standing for my original plaintiff that had no standing. And the court said, no, you can't do that. If you file a case by a plaintiff with no standing, you have no case, and it cannot be amended.
That's not this case at all, is it, Mr. Wall?
I mean, the default rule is if you have a missing necessary party, you just bring them in. Now, you can't proceed further until they're joined. So that's sort of the default rule. So what might make this different? And the only thing I could think of, and maybe you can help me, is one, it's a tax statute strictly construed, so you have that in your favor. And two, there's an underlying purpose, which is the right of these folks to redeem it so it's not lost at foreclosure. And they're, in a sense, deprived of that when you go straight to court and they haven't had notice. So those are the two things. Is there more that would make this different from the ordinary default rule that, hey, you're right, we have a missing necessary party, we just add them and go forward?
Well, what I would say on that one, Justice McCullough, is, for example, when this court enforces its own rules, as in the Wellmore Coal Corp. v. Harmon case, you had a notice of appeal that was filed by out-of-state counsel. It was promptly amended. But the court said, rules are rules, and your notice of appeal did not comply with our rules. Thus, you cannot amend it. It used the phrase, there was nothing to amend. And so I'm not unmindful of your premise, Justice McCullough. I understand there is no case that I can pull off the shelf that says we are just like this case. But what I am saying is that the court has recognized for a long time the concept of active jurisdiction, and that where you have a statutory cause of action, compliance with the statute is necessary for the court to acquire active jurisdiction, and that simply didn't happen in this case. I also freely concede the default rule, as you have said, is that amendments should be liberally granted, and you do not want to have cases adjudicated on technical compliance. But this case does fall within a minority of cases where you have a statutory cause of action where compliance is strictly required. And so I'm not saying that my argument is a one-size-fits-all argument that would apply to some broad group of cases. In fact, I am saying it applies only where you have a cause of action that is literally a creature statute, and the existence of the claim depends upon compliance with the statute. Before I run completely out of time, I do want to address briefly the Friends of Clark Mountain case, which was the primary authority cited by the city in opposition to our argument. As you know, in Clark Mountain, that was a zoning appeal, and necessary parties were not joined initially, and the court permitted them to be joined. In fact, after the 30-day limitation in 15.1493G, the difference is this. Zoning appeals are not a statutory process. Unlike site plans or subdivisions that have a statutory appeal protocol, zoning decisions are not subject to any such statutory process. They are just filed as declaratory judgments. And yes, there is a statute, 493G, that places the 30-day limitation on doing that. But there is nothing in the statute that is driving the claim that puts any particular joinder requirements on it. And Justice McCullough, as you observed yourself just a few months ago in the Boasso America Court versus...
It's an opinion of the court, but I understand.
Well, you made this very distinction. That no, in Boasso you have a BZA appeal where you have a statutory process and compliance with the process is required, and you specifically cited to Friends of Clark Mountain and said it doesn't apply here because you have a statutory process.
So can I interrupt you for a second? So the requirement here in our case is either give notice or make them a party, right?
Correct.
And on the second part, make them a party. Because the statutes say you've got to make them a party with your first complaint. You can't do it with an amended complaint.
As Justice Powell called me on earlier, the statute just says you must join them as a part.
So yeah. Help me out, because I'm not following the argument, because they were made a part.
Ultimately, my argument just
tells you... So what's the violation?
The violation is on the day this case was initiated, neither of the statutory requirements were fulfilled. And thus, there was no matter pending before the court.
There was no notice, that's for sure, right? But the other thing
is... No joinder.
No joinder, but I thought we just agreed that there was no requirement in the statute that joinder occur with the initial complaint. Therefore, why wouldn't we read it to mean at least sometime you've got to join them? Otherwise, you can't go forward in the case.
Not to disagree with you, but what you had me agree to was the statute doesn't say that. It doesn't say they must be joined in the initial filing. I believe that is implicit.
That's actually all I'm working with is what it says.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Walker, I'm sorry. Would you go quickly with me to your interpretation of 3969? Do you read a good faith dispute as to title of value into Romanet I?
I am going to have 3969.
With regard to when the matter can be sent to the...
Well,
it's just, Commissioner for
sale. I mean, 3969 specifically says the court can only proceed to a decree of sale and skip the reference to the Commissioner of Chancery if there is no dispute as to value.
And my question is, do you read into that a good faith dispute as to value or title?
Well, Your Honor, I guess I would agree with you that, like in all pleadings, they have to be asserted in good faith. But in this case, if you read the exchange between myself and the trial judge, we very fulsomely explained the nature of our dispute with the city's appraisal and why we wanted the opportunity to present evidence to the commissioner in chancery.
And if the trial court believed that your request to go to the commissioner in chancery was to try and get a lower valuation, which perhaps you all could then repurchase this property as opposed to paying the tax assessment, was not a good faith dispute as to title, why then was it not proper for him to deny your request?
Justice Ballas, I've only got about 15 seconds left, so
the chief will let you answer.
I'm trying to be quick, but I don't believe Judge Willis said our position was not asserted in good faith. I believe his position was driven by a construction of the statute that it is only where the landowner is arguing that the appraisal is low and wants to put in evidence of a higher value that the reference to the commissioner of chancery would be appropriate. Whereas in our case, as I explained, I laid all my cards on the table before the trial judge, and I explained that we thought Mr. Kayla's appraisal was high, and we wanted to present an evidence of a lower value to the commissioner and ultimately to the trial judge. The court read the statute to say it doesn't apply in that instance.
And did the court read the statute to say that, or did the court read the statute to say that the only way your clients could redeem this property was to pay the full tax assessment? And so to what end would one go to a special commissioner to determine that perhaps the value of the property was too high?
I understand your question, Justice Powell. I believe I am out of time. May I answer your question?
Absolutely.
Thank you. That really goes to our assignment number three, Justice Powell, where in the statute, again, 3569, same statute we're reading from your earlier question, it talks about the court may enter a decree of sale. It doesn't say the court shall enter a decree of sale. And as I argued to the trial judge, that implies the possibility of other relief. But without presenting the evidence that we sought to present to the commissioner in chancery, I don't have a factual basis upon which to make that argument. So,
question.
I guess I should sit down at this point unless there are further questions.
No, there's
questions.
A question.
Thank you very much. I do have a question. I'm trying to understand the interplay between 3965 and 67. Your argument is that there was no notice given 30 days beforehand, which would have triggered active jurisdiction upon the filing.
Yes.
If, though, they had named the trustee in that initial complaint, your argument is that would have triggered active jurisdiction.
Yes, correct. Yes.
Because they didn't name the trustee, is your argument that the court could not hear their motion in order to add the trustee, that the court simply needed to say, I've reviewed the file, there is a party missing, no one is permitted to make a motion, this case is dismissed without prejudice?
That is the whole concept of quorum non judici, that you do not have a case before
okay.
the court.
So as it is, the court granted their motion, they added the trustee.
Yes.
Came back into court days or weeks later. If the court had hypothetically had said, I can't even hear a motion because there is no active jurisdiction, this case is dismissed without prejudice, and they had walked out and refiled with the trustee an hour later, what would have been the harm to you, or what would have been the benefit to you with that alternative procedure?
I understand your question, Justice Mims, and the answer is we have been very careful in this case to play within the lines. We have not asserted any defense that could be in any way argued to have been frivolously asserted, like challenging the assessment or running into bankruptcy court or anything else. All I have done in this case from day one has been to simply try to hold the city's feet to the fire to comply with the statute, and that's what I was doing here.
All right, your time has expired.
Okay. Thank you.
I have no further questions.
Okay.
Good morning. May it please the court, John Reif. I, along with Lucas Hobbs, represent the city of Fredericksburg. Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, at the heart of these consolidated cases lies a recalcitrant landowner that is unwilling to pay the taxes that are due to the city of Fredericksburg. And the only means of holding or staving off this action is delay, to either find a buyer or to have more taxes accumulate so that when it does go to sale, the city is going to, whoever buys it, is going to pay less for the property. If in fact, the landowner comes in and bids on it at an auction, they would pay less because everyone agrees we're not going to collect all the taxes and special assessments that have been levied on these properties.
Counsel, why wasn't the trustee given notice? Was it just simply missed in the title search?
Well, I would like to say that I had a good answer. The trustee was not missed in the title search at all. Simply didn't do it. And I think that Justice Kelsey said my words almost verbatim. Well, darn, we'll go back and we'll do it again.
Okay. Probably almost verbatim.
Almost verbatim. But we did ask the court for leave to amend, which was absolutely proper. And in fact, in showing the propriety of this, you have to look no further than the cases that have been cited by the landowner. Essentially, you have Boards of Zoning Appeal cases, and you also have mechanics lien cases, which this court has ruled a number of times that you have specific time frames that you have to make your filings, and if you don't make the filings as required by statute, then you're going to be without remedy to bring in necessary parties that are required by statute. But I think Boasso goes directly to the point where the court said, as long as you get the parties right that the statute requires within the time frame that the statute allots, then you can add other necessary parties as necessary. As Justice Powell pointed out, there is no time limitation in this particular type of case, these tax sale cases that are required. 58.1, 3967 says that all necessary parties must be made defendant, period. It doesn't say at the initial filing. It doesn't say within 30 days. It doesn't say within 6 months as required in mechanics lien cases.
So your argument is one of two different propositions. Either number one, the court may have active jurisdiction even though it doesn't yet have all necessary parties in front of it. Or number two, even though the court doesn't have active jurisdiction, it may properly hear and rule upon a motion.
Yes, actually, it's the latter of those positions. Active jurisdiction, I think this court went through what is active jurisdiction pretty well in Morrison v. Bessler, which was also cited by the landowner. In that active jurisdiction is going to consist of subject matter jurisdiction, territorial jurisdiction, notice jurisdiction, and then other matters that are required by the statute in order to be fulfilled for the court to have active jurisdiction in order to afford full and fair relief.
The words are so garbled by our historical use of them, but potential or subject matter jurisdiction is power. Active jurisdiction is authority. So the question is, did the court have the authority to grant a motion for leave to amend a complaint to add a necessary party? I don't know how the answer is not, of course it did.
Well, I agree, Justice.
Can I switch gears, though, to assignment of error 2 and 3?
Yes.
Why wouldn't it have been at least better, arguably required, for the trial judge to go ahead and hear the proffer from the landowners on value before making the good cause determination? I would think a trial judge would need to hear that in order to make a reasonable judgment call.
Well, this court's long said that the use of a commissioner in chancery is at the sound discretion of the trial court, and typically the commissioner in chancery is not going to be a finder of fact, but merely going to report back the results. And in this particular case, there was extensive ore tenens argument between the counsel, and in fact, there had been no outside appraisal that had been brought in by the landowners.
So
there was really
no. Stop you right there. So the yes. Proffer was really just simply we got a lower number, but there's no information, no experts, no anything to present to the trial court, or did the trial court shut that down?
Well, there wasn't a modicum of evidence that was provided to the court, and the court actually provided an opportunity for the landowner to take a recess so that the landowner could call our expert, who we had on standby just in case we needed him.
So your point there is there's just no proffer. We don't know. For all we know, it's error but harmless. We don't know what the number was. Could have been $10 off.
And Your Honor, I don't think there was any error at all, because if you look at Virginia Code Section 58.1-3969, in addition to the Romanets that talk about appointing a decree of sale, or a commission for a decree of sale, The very first sentence, I think, therein establishes what is not a de novo review, but actually an abuse of discretion review by this court in the court's ruling. Specifically, it says that the court shall have the option, which is discretionary language, for good cause shown, which requires the court to make a finding, after proper objection from a party defendant, which is what we have in this case. They objected, saying that we think the city's value doesn't take into all factors. They didn't say they disagree with the city's appraisal, which appraised each of the properties as they were taxed, because these properties are owned by, I think, five different individuals, which is why we have five different cases. So these properties weren't assessed for taxes as a whole. They were assessed individually. They were taxed individually, and they're being collected individually, which stands to reason that you're going to appraise them individually to give the court an apples-to-apples comparison if you take them to sale, and they're going to be sold individually and reported back to the court individually.
So in a nutshell, your point is the proffer was too inspecific and unsubstantiated for us to say abuse of discretion occurred.
Well, Your Honor, to clarify, my point is there was nothing before the court. There may have been a different value, but the landowners didn't take the opportunity to provide any sort of good cause for the court to decide that there was a real issue that needed to be expanded on by a commissioner in chancery. This court has stated in Rayford v. Rayford that the one, if not the only evil of appointing a commissioner in chancery is where such appointment is going to cause unnecessary expense and delay. And we're already underwater with these cases. So every delay we have, every month we have delayed, is additional interest that we're not going to collect. Every 6 months it goes is another tax assessment that's not going to be collected. So in this case, I think this is specifically in the line of Rayford v. Rayford, and there was nothing else to explore, and appointment of Commissioner Chancery would have served no purpose. To the end that
Am I correct that under the statute, even if it had gone to a Commissioner in Chancery, a lower fair market value had been established in order for Mr. Walk's clients to redeem this property, they would still have to pay the full tax assessment?
Justice Powell, you were going right where I was going. Simply put, even if we went to a commissioner in chancery or the court said, I think this is worth half of the amount, there's no statutory authority for the city to take any less than what has been assessed in order to redeem the properties. The landowners are asking this court to read a lot into these statutes and to ignore some. And specifically, they're asking this court to ignore 58.13974, which requires, and the only method of redemption is to pay everything that's due, tax, penalty, interest, cost, reasonable attorney's fees. So there wouldn't have been any opportunity, even if we went before Commissioner Chancery and a different value was arrived at. This court has addressed that specific issue in Alexander v. Commonwealth in 1923. That involved a case that went to a commissioner in chancery wherein it was determined that the taxes on the property actually were should not have been assessed to begin with. And the court said, well, the landowner had every right to challenge these under what is now Code Sections 58.13984 through a judicial process to challenge the taxes that were assessed. And their failure to do so and try to bring it up during the tax collection proceeding is an impermissible collateral attack on the taxes that were duly assessed. So I don't even think they can bring that up in this context. They can't wait for the tax man to come looking for the money before they decide, well, we think the taxes are too high. They actually have to be active and proactive in presenting their case that the taxes are too high. So specifically, I did want to go back and touch on the first assignment of error and the allowance of the amended complaint to bring in the trustees. We didn't simply join new parties. You know, we went back and we amended the complaint, and the amended complaint serves to supplant the other complaint. The only difference if we had amended the complaint versus if we started over, it would have allowed for a little bit of additional delay, which, as Mr. Walk had said just a moment ago, that they've attempted to play within the lines, and they have. They're playing with this as long as they can to draw it out, as long as they can, and that's why we're here again, is to draw it out. But what we want to do and what we're asking this court to do is to allow us to affirm the lower court's ruling. No error was committed in bringing in new parties. To say that error was committed in bringing in new parties when there's not a specific time frame that allows bringing in new parties or amending the complaint puts these entire types of cases for tax collection in a procedural island that doesn't exist anywhere else. It asks the court to ignore 8.01-5 for joining parties, Rule 1:8, and Rule 316, and is not well-founded in either law, fact, statute, or otherwise. So we ask this court to affirm the lower court ruling and to also rule that the errors 2 and 3 are no error at all, simply because there was nothing else to develop with a commissioner in chancery, and the court had everything that it needed before it, and it's up to the parties to bring in their evidence the day it's heard and the day we noticed that we were going to argue this and say there was no good cause for appointing the commissioner in chancery. And we ask this court to allow my client to sell the property, to collect the delinquent taxes that are owed, which are now north of $20 million and growing. Thank you for the court's time.
The court will be in recess until 11:05.